This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So if you care about climate, if you care about reducing vulnerability to climate change or climate hazards, and you leave off the list of things that you want to think about, something like family planning or access to family planning information in Africa, then you're missing a big chunk of the problem.
The United Nations forecasts that by 2050, the world's population will exceed 9 billion. How will that affect life on the local level, on the global level, and in developing countries? And what impact will all these new humans have on the climate? Last week on Sea Change Radio, we talked with Paul Ehrlich, iconic authority on the subject of population. Today we continue our exploration of the topic, speaking first with New York Times environmental reporter and Dot Earth blogger Andrew Revkin, and then later with Stuart Brand, frequent guest, former student of Paul Ehrlich, an environmentalist icon in his own right. Both guests share their thoughts on how immigration, urbanization, religion, and the increasing global empowerment of women are affecting the population equation.
Always in fear is fear itself. Check out your own backyard before you check out someone else. Railroad track in my neighborhood.
My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Andy Revkin. He has been a reporter for nearly 15 years for the New York Times. He left at the end of 2009 to become a senior fellow at Pace University's Pace Academy for Applied Environmental Studies. And he continues to write for the Dot Earth blog, which is still part of the New York Times network. Andy, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be with you.
So you've been writing recently about the population boom and humanity is about to pass the 7 billion threshold and apparently on its way to 9 billion, demographers predict, by 2050. And what do you think these numbers mean in terms of our ability to take care of our environment?
The uncomfortable answer is it depends. Right now, it's pretty clear that there's enough food to feed people. What's happened recently is the crunch in prices for food has come mainly because there's a ballooning middle class in the world wanting to eat up the food chain. And that has put pressure for the poorest people in the world on their prices, so they can barely afford food. So the growing demands of the global middle class are stretching the capacity of the poorest people on the planet to feed themselves. But that's all. There's a lot of plasticity there. And on the blog, I did a piece that got at that recently, beyond the eternal food fight, you know, between those who are saying we're over the edge and those who are saying technology and productivity and agriculture will always keep up. And so I don't have a deep concern that we're going to have massive famine. There will be, again, a small number of proportion of the human population that's going to have a real hard time. But that's kind of what I would love to see, is ways to whittle that down for sure. Water is an issue, but there too, technology can provide substantial wiggle room in terms of, in some places, desalination, which then leads, of course, to energy. You know, anything like that requires energy. And then the other issues are, how much biodiversity do you want on that planet once we have 9 billion people? And that's a values question. I've been writing for years, since 2003 or so, about the question of how much nature is not enough. And that's a very uncomfortable question for people to ask themselves. But we are coming to the point where we're going to have to make decisions that are like that.
And that decision is kind of being made by the migration patterns of the whole world now. The whole world is half urban, and that's increasing. With increasing urbanization, how do you think nature will play a role in that?
You've kind of hit on the double-edged the double-edged aspect of what's happening with humans right now. Urbanization is a good thing for nature in the sense that the more people are densely living, and the more also agricultural production, for example, is getting more intensive. You can make more, grow more crops on the same amount of land, then you don't have to keep taking down more rainforest to grow what we need. So intensification, concentration of human activities can be a great boon to nature in that sense. But as we move to cities and we move on to the internet, more of our experience, we're cutting ourselves off from nature as well. And I wrote recently, for example, about whether Google adding the oceans to Google Earth, meaning that now you can explore the oceans on your computer just like you could explore the Rocky Mountains before. I didn't just write about the news that they put the oceans in 3D on Google Earth. I wrote about, would that matter? In other words, do you have to still get wet to care about the oceans? And the answer from sociologists and psychologists was still kind of a probably, that digital experience can make, you know, you watch a movie about dolphins being slaughtered, and that can change some behaviors. But there's still a sense that without a real sort of physical connection in our lives to nature, then we'll care less about it. So again, that leads to this question of in a world that's ever more urban and ever more virtual, can we maintain the passion to preserve the biodiversity that we have cherished as we grew up?
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and my guest is Andy Revkin, a longtime environmental reporter for the New York Times who runs the .Earth blog for the Times. Andy,
let's look at it just from a pure population number and what that urbanization means. Right now, we're, as I mentioned, close to 7 billion. What do you think that 9 billion means? Because to many, that is a good thing. That's the peak. And then we can start going down, which would be the first time in humanity, really, that population has started to go down. Or do you think that's something that we need to fear and prepare for?
Well, you can't disregard the importance of population, for the most part, is still local. The impacts of populations are at the local level.
Yeah, you write about cluster bombs, right? Can you explain how that ties in with this concept?
Early on in .Earth, in 2007, I did a post on this, looking at the old concept of the population bomb, which, of course, dates from the 60s and the work of Paul Ehrlich. And that was all built around this kind of world global view that there would be mass famine and utter disruption of civilizations because we were just going past, carrying capacity in big ways. What's become clear since then is that the stresses that are created by rapid population growth or rapid population concentration are local. And so there are areas in the world that are seeing all of those population bomb style problems, high mortality, rampant waterborne disease, lack of sanitation. But at the same time, there's a big chunk of the world now that's living, pretty much in balance, the sort of mid-range folks. And then there's countries that are imploding, Russia, Japan, which demographers expect Japan's population, without big changes in their attitudes toward immigration, will be about half of what it is now, later in the century, because it's getting older and there's not a high reproductive rate. So you have a world where there are, as I said, cluster bombs. There's sort of explosive areas like many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and then there are these imploders. And, if you were sort of the macroeconomic god, you'd say, hey, well, you just do more migration and more immigration. You get young labor forces where you need them, and everything works out. But, of course, as you see in Europe and much of Asia, and, of course, in the United States, immigration is an incredibly divisive topic. So things that when you have pent up issues, then you have conflict.
Well, some of the biggest problems that demographers foresee would be in Africa, but that's also a rapidly urbanizing continent, right?
Yeah. In fact, I don't think I'll ever forget. I was at the UN several years ago at a meeting on actually trying to push the climate change issue, but it was a lunch with a lot of environment ministers from around the world. I was sitting next to the environment minister from Angola, and he was kind of looking around and clucking at people and saying, climate is not something I can deal with right now. Luanda, our main city, went from 500,000 to 5 million people since 1975. And I'm just struggling to get the water to work, to get any kind of sewage treatment, to get basic functionality. And so don't talk to me about global warming. And that is a big chunk of the world still. There's 2.6 billion people, as I've written repeatedly on .Earth, with no place to safely go to the toilet, for example. And that's a real problem.
I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Fred Pierce, and he has a book called The Coming Population Collapse.
Yeah, sure.
Can you speak to the coming population collapse that some foresee?
Well, it's kind of like, yes, maybe. The funny thing about his book is, and I've been meaning to write about it, but I'm so backlogged I haven't. The headline in the book is Population Collapse. But when you look carefully at the contents, it's a huge amount of uncertainty there. And in fact, there are a number of developing countries around the world that had seen sharply declining fertility rates where things have ticked around in the other direction. So you can't presume this will all play out smoothly. There's no one among the demographers, the many, many demographers and population experts I've been interviewing in recent years, who sees a crash of any sort anytime before mid-century, one way or the other. So we're heading toward somewhere between 8 and 10 billion people, with 9 still being kind of the best guess outcome, and with a pretty high confidence level. But none of this is assured, mainly because, you know, one of the least certain things on the planet is human behavior. There's some aspects of our behavior that are utterly predictable, but others we're still learning about and aren't predictable.
Yes, you've written that, quote, 9 billion vegan monks wouldn't have much chance of overloading Earth's systems. And of course, we're not all going to become vegan monks.
Correct. And even in India right now, you see, India put out its 2011 census, which I wrote about just the other day. There's a bunch of fascinating findings there. One is that technology in recent decades in India, coupled with very ancient cultural norms preferring male progeny, has led to an enormous rate of selective abortion and a growing divergence in the number of males and females in the population from what would be the average, fewer females. This happened in China as well, and there's signs of it happening in Vietnam and other places. So the simple thing of cheap ultrasound has substantially changed India's kind of population prognosis, yet another sort of secondary thing you wouldn't normally think about.
Every triangle has three corners, every triangle has three sides, no more, no less. You don't have to guess. When it's three, you can see it's a magic number. A man and a woman had a little baby. Yes, they did. They had three in the family. That's a magic number. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and my guest is Andy Revkin, a longtime environmental reporter for the New York Times who runs the Dot Earth blog for the Times. So you mentioned immigration as another hot button issue, and obviously that's something here in the U.S. which is a constant political football. But in terms of a global issue, how you said that the issue is usually perceived as being a poor country problem, but it's not, right?
Well, the United States is an unusual case of a rich industrialized country with a rapidly growing population. Now, here it's not because of high fertility rates; it's because of high immigration rates, a million or so a year. And you look at the trajectories, and we're heading toward a population of 400 million or more, you know, well before mid-century. And when you have that level of growth in the number of Americans compared to growth in the number of, say, Haitians or Botswanans, there's a much larger resource per capita use here, whether it's energy or anything else. So it has larger ramifications in that sense to have a fast-growing population in a rich country. And I did a piece asking the uncomfortable question, what's the right number of Americans? And, of course, there'll be a huge range of answers to that question.
So what were some of the conclusions that the study found?
Well, basically there, it's the same answer. It depends. It does mean that this is what led me into hot water with a fellow called Rush Limbaugh. This is before the climate bill failed, and there's been all this talk of trading carbon credits of various kinds, and I've written a lot about the dubious aspects of having markets and carbon for a variety of reasons. But I said, look, if you're going to get carbon-centric about everything, then, and you look at these trends in U.S. population, you might think, well, maybe if we're going to have carbon credits for planting trees or whatever, maybe there would be carbon credit for an American young couple having fewer kids than they might otherwise have. And that post, and another one about, are condoms the ultimate green technology, prompted Rush Limbaugh to do on his radio show one day something like, Mr. Andrew Revkin of the New York Times, if you think people are the worst thing that ever happened to this planet, why don't you just go kill yourself and save the planet by dying? He spent three shows the following week almost apologizing. I think some advertiser or somebody at the station who had had a bad experience with suicide must have been pressing him to kind of backtrack, but he never quite did it. But it was an interesting moment, let's put it that way.
The philosophy that he's espousing seems to be very rich nation, U.S.-centric. I don't know if he would have the same view if he spent a lot of time in that city that you mentioned. I forget the country, but it went from 500,000 to 5 million in a matter of years. Or if he lived in Pakistan, which had 50 million people in the 50s and now is about to become the fourth most populous country in the world. These are issues that are serious. They're not just a political football to be tossed around, right?
No, although, you know, in our current media atmosphere, they often end up just being that.
Let's just talk about the U.S. then. Do you think population is a real concern in this country?
You know, I don't really think it's an issue per se. I do think as the country, if the country ever gets serious about grappling with the question of what to do about climate, you can't kind of take population off the list of things to think about. And this relates to even to programs or efforts we would want to foster in developing countries, where the two things are happening that are most important related to climate change. One is most of the emissions growth coming in the planet, nearly all of it, will be coming in fast-growing developing countries in Asia. And most of the exposure to climate hazard is also in developing countries. We have we did a big series in the Times 2007 called The Climate Divide, which illustrated vividly that the countries with the biggest history of emitting greenhouse gases, like the United States and Western Europe, have the most capacity through wealth and technology to insulate themselves from that risk, while the poorest countries don't. So if you care about climate, if you care about reducing vulnerability to climate change or climate hazards, and you leave off the list of things that you want to think about, something like family planning or access to family planning information and Africa, then you're missing a big chunk of the problem. And one of the simple illustrations I gave on the blog of that a little while ago was that much of sub-Saharan Africa, north of South Africa, is going to see a doubled population between now and 2050. And it's a region that already experiences a huge amount of climate extremes just as part of their natural climate system there. So you're going to double exposure to that by doubling the number of poor people. And then we're also adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere that, you know, it's still complicated to know how that's going to affect Africa's climate. So if you care about climate, you have to care about the size of families in Africa. And this is always quickly attacked by sort of population critics as being some kind of draconian effort to control populations. But it's already shown, there was just another recent study of what's called unmet need. If anyone is interested, just Google for the phrase unmet need and the word population or the word family, and you'll find recent studies on how many women out there would love to have access to and know about already condoms and other kinds of birth control methods, but don't have access to them. So it's not like anyone's forcing people. There are literally tens of millions of families who would like to benefit from these things and don't have access to them.
Whether we like it or not, this is one of those topics where religion and science intersect. And religion has injected itself into population and family control since the outset of these religions. Maybe that leads into a more hypersensitive environment when we discuss solutions.
The heads of religions, like the Pope, when he went to Africa, whenever it was a year or two ago, and spoke about condoms as contributing to HIV problems there, didn't do the issue any good. But as you mentioned earlier, there are countries, including Catholic countries, that have very low fertility rates now, so it's not like everybody's listening to the Pope. And in the Middle East as well, which is tending to have very high fertility rates, persistent in many places.
But even when you get attacked by a Rush Limbaugh, there's an element of religiosity in that as well, I believe.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that there's evidence that even in places with strict religious backgrounds, I was going to mention Iran, has shifted to a very low, through family access to family planning and education, greatly reduced the fertility rate there. You can have action and progress in places even if there's fundamentalism.
So my guest on Sea Change Radio has been Andy Revkin. After nearly 15 years of reporting for the New York Times, he has become a senior fellow at the Pace University's Academy for Applied Environmental Studies. He continues to write for the New York Times via the .earth blog. Andy, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Stuart Brand, an American writer best known as the editor of the Whole Earth Catalog. He founded a number of organizations, including The Well, the Global Business Network, and the Long Now Foundation. He's the author of several books, most recently, Whole Earth Discipline. Welcome to Sea Change Radio, Stuart.
Thank you for having me.
Where do you see things going in terms of population density? That nightmare scenario of continuously rising population that we've heard about for so many years seems to maybe not be coming to fruition. What do you attribute that to?
We seem to be in the last couple decades of population rise. It's leveling off fast. It's leveling off faster than the demographers expected, and leveling off way faster than us environmentalists expected. I used to be an activist worrying about population, partly because one of my teachers at Stanford was Paul Ehrlich. But what happened is the whole world is now half urban, and 1.3 million people a week are new in town. And what's happening is people move from the countryside into town. The first thing that occurs there is they are pursuing opportunity, and the women start having fewer children. And as soon as birth rate gets to 2.1, that's a replacement rate. Everybody in the demography world thought, well, you know, in the best of all scenarios, we'll get to the point where it levels off at 2.1 and then we can relax. Well, what's happening is that in most places in the world that have urbanized, the fertility rate, the birth rate, goes way below that. In places like Italy and Brazil, it's 1.3 babies per woman.
Those are Catholic countries too.
Catholic countries. So what's going on? But the same thing is happening in Muslim countries and elsewhere. And a country that has a 1.3 children per woman fertility rate halves its population in 45 years, and then halves it again in the next 45 years, and then halves it again in the next 45 years. So these are extinction numbers. It means that we are indeed in having a carrying capacity problem up until maybe the 2040s. And then we may have the opposite problem of places like Japan or Eastern Europe that have very, very few young people coming along. That's your workforce. And so the economy takes often a permanent hit as people just get older and older and less productive. And Social Security evaporates and all those good things. There's a very good book I would recommend to your listeners, new book by Fred Pierce, who's a science writer in England. The book is called, In This Country, The Coming Population Collapse. The Coming Population Collapse is I've been studying population on and off for decades now, and there was all kinds of news to me in this rather wonderful book. The great thing about Fred Pierce is that, unlike me, he's traveled all these places in the world where these things are playing out. One of the things he points out is that the urbanization that I was just talking about is really a female event. Women are the ones who are driving not only the size of urbanization, but the quality of urbanization. They're the ones who typically, they're not only the ones you want to give the microfinance loans to, they're the ones who are organizing the community-based organizations in the slums and starting businesses, getting their kids educated, moving ahead on the medical stuff, pushing for sanitation.
And you view this flow of people to the cities as in an optimistic light. And it kind of flies, though, in the face of the environmentalist tree hugger archetype that we think of. But do you think wanting to live closer to nature is maybe an ecologically irresponsible decision in today's world or not?
Well, it's a little bit of a reversal for me, because the Whole Earth Catalog back in the 60s and 70s was seen as a back to the land device in a way. And I set it up to serve the various communes that I knew and had participated in to help them reinvent civilization, which is sort of the task at hand as far as they were concerned. And some of those communes were urban, but most were quite rural. The idea was to go out to some remote place and start over. And indeed, a lot of the environmental movement gets its oomph from basically people hiking or having some profound experience in the depth of nature and feeling like this is sacred, nature has to be protected, and they're right about that. But I will say environmentalists have caught on in the last 10 or 15 years, pretty much starting from the realization that sprawl was a harmful thing, that an excess of suburbs was tough on the environment, but also pretty tough in a way for the people living there. To drive endlessly, you're always chauffeuring your kids around from one play date to a karate practice to another. And the kind of bike-to world that I grew up with in the 40s and 50s is harder to find now because people are so spread out. It's a different thing in the developing world. In the developing world, the major advantages of people moving to town is they stop being subsistence farmers, which is ecologically probably the most harmful thing that people do, because it's typically on poor agricultural land. People beat themselves bloody trying to get food out of that land. They're not in the cash economy, so they're stuck there. It's a poverty trap. And as soon as they go join their uncle in town and leave the subsistence farm behind, typically nobody tries to take it over, and especially in the tropics, it grows back very rapidly. The animals that are wild animals that are not being trapped and shot for food anymore come back. And so there's a whole lot of recovery going on throughout the developing world, just of people moving to town and the countryside coming back behind them.
Stuart Brand, the author of Whole Earth Discipline, thank you for joining us on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you for having me along.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Aaron Neville, Bob Duro, and Ronnie Earle. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.